SEC fans, this is John Crist from Saturday Down South. Welcome to another episode of the SDS Podcast, coming to you from the iHeartMedia Studio, WDAE in Tampa, Florida, 620 AM, 95.3 FM. Be sure to follow me on Twitter at SaturdayJC. Our guest for this episode is former Florida wide receiver Chris Doering. He's currently an analyst for SEC Network. You can follow him on Twitter at Chris Doering. Chris, thank you so much for joining me on today's program.
Oh, no, thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Absolutely. Anytime. Before we get into the Q&A, the Saturday Down South podcast is brought to you by Crystal. If you're listening to the podcast, then you know the South loves football. You know what the South also loves? Crystal. That's right. Crystal, home with a classic Crystal burger. They're ready to hook you up for your tailgate. The Crystal, the one you grew up with, the one you loved in college well after midnight. Right now, only 79 cents each, all day, every day, as many as you want, 79 cents. And because no tailgate is complete without wings, Crystal has you covered there. All wings, any wings, 49 cents a pop, all day Saturday and Sunday. Boneless wings, traditional bone-in wings, buffalo, barbecue, any wing, any flavor, 49 cents each all weekend long. Best of all, Crystal is taking care of our podcast listeners. Text SDS, the letters SDS, to 37793 right now, and you're going to get two free crystals. That's SDS to 37793 via text message. Free crystals, 79-cent crystals, 49-cent wings. I guarantee if you show up to your tailgate with a steamer pack of crystals, you're going to be named MVP. Stop by your local Crystal today. And now, Chris Doering. And Chris, based on how the Florida offense has looked so far, I'm guessing you probably wish you had a little eligibility left.
Well, shoot, I think there's a lot more that's needed just in one slow, skinny white wide receiver. You know, I mean, I think there's some deficiencies in that offense across the board. And, you know, I do feel like they made some strides on the offensive line, but protection's still an issue, primarily because of the running back position. I mean, multiple times in the last two games, you've seen guys just completely bust protections that they should have blocked against the blitz, and it's just, it's unacceptable. I mean, it's dangerous for a quarterback, and that's one of the places I think you see Jordan Scarlett being out of the lineup really having an impact on this offense. You know, additionally, I think you're talking about a quarterback, obviously, that's only made two starts, that they've simplified the offense for, that they've minimized the reads that he's trying to make. But as he gains more confidence and experience, I'm sure you'll see more of that kind of open up for him too. But right now, this is a very young offense. You saw a bunch of young playmakers that have some explosiveness that are going to bring some excitement to the offense, but just don't have a lot of reps under their belts.
Now, of course, the easy thing to do is just to put everything on the quarterback position. They get all the credit when things go well, all the blame when they don't. But it sounds like you're sort of giving Felipe Franks a little bit of a pass here because he's not getting the protection up front, and wide receivers aren't running their routes properly, getting open, and guys are missing blocks on blitzers and the like. So it sounds like, clearly, Franks is not getting the help he needs to succeed.
Well, I mean, I think that's part of it. And as you know, football is the ultimate team sport. You know, with 11 guys having an individual assignment, if one of those guys doesn't complete that assignment, many times you have a play that's a breakdown. So I think there is certainly blame to be placed on Felipe Franks. He missed some reads, missed some wide-open guys on Saturday against Tennessee. Not getting the ball out as quickly as I'd like to see him get it out. But you referenced something that I mentioned on SEC Now last week, and that was against Michigan. These wide receivers got no separation whatsoever. They were playing a lot of cover one, single high safety, man-to-man on the outside, and you have to be able to win. You're not going to be able to run the football against that type of front when they have an extra guy down there to run support. So you got to be able to win on the outside, and Florida's receivers just didn't do that. Subsequently, against Tennessee, you saw some new guys get opportunities in there, particularly Kadarius Toney, who I thought was really dangerous with the football in his hands. But you're absolutely right. I mean, it's a total situation where everybody's not playing to the level of the expectation heading into the season. I was one that was really convinced that this offense was going to be very, very good with the experience and depth at wide receiver, with the offensive line being a strength of the team. New offensive line coach Brad Davis has got those guys reinvigorated, and unfortunately, they just haven't played that way to this point in time.
Now, that being said, if you have an ace quarterback, he can make up for a lot of disadvantages at other places, and the Gators just don't have that right now. They haven't for quite some time. Just give me your general assessment of the quarterback position in Gainesville. Felipe Franks clearly the guy. I wonder if the Malik Zaire experiment is already over. He did not get one snap against Tennessee. I also wonder if we still might see Luke Del Rio at some point. I know he doesn't have a very high ceiling, but I think he may have a higher floor than an inexperienced guy like Franks.
Yeah, I was convinced, actually, that Del Rio was going to win the job heading into the season. From the reports that I had heard from folks that I trust on the inside, it was Del Rio that was leading, it was Franks in second, and it was Zaire at a distant third. And I think you made the assessment that he may kind of be done at Florida. I think you, from time to time, may see a zone read package that he comes in and executes, but I clearly believe that he doesn't know the offense very well, doesn't know where to go with the football. You could see that he was slow in his progressions against Michigan. That was really frustrating to the coaching staff, so I think he's been relegated to that third quarterback spot. But I agree with you. I think Del Rio, from a knowing the playbook standpoint, from the options that he gives you to do everything in your offense, this is a team that does have playmakers, and really what you need is a guy to distribute the football, and I thought Del Rio was the perfect fit for that. Now, with that being said, I've been impressed with what I've seen from Felipe Franks. When you go with a freshman quarterback, which he is, we remember he's a redshirt freshman and only played now two games at the college level, you're going to have some growing pains. You're going to have a curve that you're going to have to deal with as he gets some experience. And so I think that they're at the point this year, understanding that there's a lot of young players on the team, it's probably better for the future to let these guys get some experience now, live with those growing pains for the fruit that it's going to bear later on as their careers kind of move forward at Florida.
Now, we're going to move on to the receiver position, of course, which is your baby. But one more question on Malik Zaire. I know that when you're having beers at the bar with your buddies, and it sounds fun and it makes a lot of sense to throw Zaire in there as this changeup and do this read option stuff, and he's a great athlete, and he can move the chains with his legs. But you saw it in the Michigan game very quickly. When he entered the huddle, that Michigan defense had zero respect for any sort of downfield passing game. Everyone crashing the line of scrimmage, 8-9 men in the box. They're taking away every gap that's available. It's just way too predictable if you bring him in as this change of pace, because the whole building is going to know what's coming for the most part.
Well, to some degree. I mean, it's kind of the same situation when you go Wildcat, though, and you remember
that's true.
The birth of the Wildcat, was that Collins at Arkansas, I guess? Who was it they ran in?
Darren McFadden.
Yeah, McFadden. There wasn't much threat of the pass there either, and at that point in time it was relatively new, but you're still seeing success. Kentucky runs it with Benny Snell successfully. So I think there is a way that you can mix that in. It's not something that you can do on a total drive every down situation, but if you bring a guy in, and I would say that he has better throwing ability than a lot of the folks that we've seen run Wildcat stuff. So maybe there's a chance to mix it in, but I'm not a huge fan of moving through different quarterbacks within a game. Think back to the days with David Green and DJ Shockley. I guess maybe that was one of the better ways of utilizing multiple quarterbacks. But at the same time, I remember against Florida where, you know, they take David Green out, put Shockley in, and there's a pick six thrown that changes the whole flow of the game. So I think sometimes coaches try to get a little too cute with what they're doing in an effort to throw off the defensive coordinators.
All right, let's move off the passers and to the pass catchers. Now, Antonio Callaway, he clearly seems irreplaceable in this offense. Football naturally has a next man up philosophy. Tyree Cleveland was one of the heroes in that Tennessee game, but let's face it, he really made one play. And these other receivers really haven't stepped up in Callaway's absence. Just taking that guy off the field, it seems to single-handedly transform some of the, you know, just a couple of pages in this playbook.
It does, and I don't want to completely place blame on the other receivers as being the difference in their passing game being successful versus it not being successful with Callaway in there, because as we've already talked about, there's a number of different issues that I feel like affecting the success of the passing game. But with that being said, we know Callaway can get open. We know he is a guy that would feast on one-on-one coverage, and I actually would be prone to say that defenses probably wouldn't play as much cover one if you had a Callaway in the game. I think they're trying to shade a safety maybe his way to take away the deep ball, something he does really, really well. But the fact of the matter is, He's not in the lineup now, and I don't think he'll ever be back. I don't think he'll play at Florida again. That's just my own personal assessment. But they're going to have to find a way to live without him. There are a number of guys that I think are talented that can take over those deep ball opportunities. I think Tyree Cleveland's still a work in progress, but we know he's got that burst. He's been doing well. He's doing well in the kickoff returns in Callaway's place too. So there's playmakers there, and as you saw it in the Tennessee game, they're just continuing to identify who those guys are and getting those guys more and more touches. Not only at the receiver spot, but Malik Davis is a guy they wanted to get the football in the Michigan game, just didn't have enough snaps to spread the ball around because of the deficiencies on offense. So I think you'll still continue to see guys getting opportunities, and the more they produce, the more they're going to take a larger step in this offense.
Now, let me ask you what might be a little bit of an uncomfortable question. You're at Florida for 5 years, redshirt, and then 4 very productive seasons, and we're talking about the heyday of Steve Spurrier, and you guys were just loaded, throwing the ball, receivers everywhere, quarterbacks who could sling it, but you probably had some kids on that roster who ran afoul of the law. What is it like as a teammate when you have a player who's so good, who's so important to what you do, and he just won't stay in line? We know that Antonio Callaway has had several transgressions over the years. The kid can play, but for some reason, between the ears, it's just not firing properly. When you're one of the good citizens, how do you handle something like that?
Well, let me say, it's not only connected to the guys that are on the current team. As an alum, as a former player at the University of Florida, you know, he represents all of us, and it's frustrating to me to see a guy that has all the talent in the world that means so much to this team, to his teammates, to the coaches, to the former players, and yet can't do the right things to stay in the lineup. And not only the right things, we're talking about some things that are now character questions. You see a lot of young guys make bad decisions, but we're seeing repetitive instances of things that I would relate as character problems. So from that standpoint, it's not the kind of representation that we expect as former players there. I think, you know, as a teammate, he's supposed to be a leader at this point in time. He's a guy that's been very productive as a player, and you look to those type of guys in the offseason to make the right choices. And I think what you see, and I don't know enough about it, so I don't want to come down on something that I don't know enough about, but there's a lot of young guys that were involved in that little scheme. And when you have a guy that's that experienced, that's visible in the program, that's doing something like that, I would venture to guess that maybe there's some negative leadership going on there in that situation. So it's frustrating as a player on a team when guys don't get in trouble. I mean, when guys don't do the right thing and get in trouble. I would say at the same time, when I was at Florida, we didn't have a bunch of guys that were doing the wrong things. I think there was something to be said for the type of guys that Coach Berger and his staff were recruiting, the type of ability to weed guys out early on. He was a guy that said from the get-go, if you don't do what we require you to do to be a Gator, you're not going to be on the team. I've seen many guys leave early in their career that probably could have had some pretty successful seasons at Florida and just weren't doing the right things off the field and never had a chance to progress. So with that being said, I do give credit to Coach McElwain for suspending these guys. It's affected their depth significantly. When you suspend two of your best players on offense, you know you're putting your season at risk. And so for him to make those decisions that can affect his win-loss total, that can affect his reputation with the university, I certainly give him a lot of credit for that.
Now let's move on to one bright spot for this Florida offense so far. And you mentioned his name earlier, Kadarius Toney. He flashed in the spring game, kind of came out of nowhere. But this kid is electric. You put the ball in his hands and things happen. It's undeniable. He has that it factor that you just can't coach. But at the same point, he's a true freshman. I think he was only a 3-star recruit. He was a high school quarterback. He ran the ball a lot. He threw the ball a lot, put up big numbers. But he's clearly new to playing the wide receiver position. How much can you possibly expect of this young man? How much can he truly learn on the fly, playing a position he's never done before? So we know, get him the ball, good things will happen. But in terms of learning a route tree and some of the blocking assignments and just lining up properly and coming out of the huddle, he's really learning fresh here.
First off, let me say thank you to you for identifying how difficult it is to play the receiver position.
Hey, I was one once upon a time.
You hear guys all the time say that oh, you can just make, he's an athlete, you put him at receiver, he'll do well. That's not the case. I mean, there's so many little nuances. There's so many detailed things to playing that position that I don't think you can just put anybody out there. Now, with that being said, Kadarius Toney may be new to the position, but he's not new to carrying the football. So you're seeing them get him the ball on little short wide receiver screens, on jet sweeps, and they'll add more to it as he learns the nuances of the position, as he learns how to run routes, as he learns how to get in and out of breaks. But right now, you're just trying to find ways to get your guys that are explosive, as you mentioned, the football and let them make plays after the catch. Because, man, he makes guys miss as easy as anybody that I've ever seen, and it really is electric to watch him with the football.
So Saturday in Lexington, you were 13 the last time Kentucky beat Florida. I was 11. There are a lot of people picking this as the upset, despite the 30-game winning streak. I'm on record. I am one of them. Is this the year it finally happens and the Cats prevail and make a signature win? Or is this just going to be one of those things where the experts are getting way too off the deep end here? Florida will find a way and lay the smack down, because that's just what they do historically in this rivalry.
Well, you know, I'm close to being one of those guys, too, that's going to go on record to take Kentucky. It's a very difficult position for me to be in. But as an analyst, you look at some of the things right now. I don't think Florida's a great football team, as we've talked about throughout the podcast so far. They have a ton of deficiencies, and we haven't even really talked about the defense. I mean, it was embarrassing in the fourth quarter when you got a 10-point lead and an opportunity to close out an opponent that you can't get stops. You got teams backed up. You're letting them go 80 yards on four or five plays, gashing your defense with runs up the middle with screens. It was certainly a concern to me as I'm watching. But at the same time, I really think the big matchup here has to do with Kentucky's offensive line versus Florida's defensive line. That still is the strength of this team. They got depth there. It's not going to be 100 degrees with 95% humidity. It's not going to be an afternoon game. I think that plays to Florida's advantage a little bit. And I've been disappointed up until that South Carolina game with Kentucky's offensive line. Now, I know they lost Cole Mosier early in the season. I know they've had some issues in trying to find the right combination. But that was the strength of the team last year. After Drew Barker went down, they became a team that was committed to running the football, that got physical up front and blew people off the line. I'm just not sure they're going to be able to do that against Florida. And if it comes down to a situation now where they can't run, can Steven Johnson throw the football effectively enough to carry that offense? I'm just not so sure.
Yeah, John Toth is a guy they clearly miss at the center position. I think they're not as good there this year as they were a year ago. You're listening to the Saturday Down South podcast. Our guest is former Florida receiver and current SEC Network analyst Chris Doering. The SDS podcast is brought to you by mybookie.ag. For as long as we've been covering football, people always ask us for predictions and picks against the spread. One of the things people always forget is that where you bet is sometimes just as important as who you're betting on. That's why we always send our friends to mybookie.ag. MyBookie has been in the business for years. They have a great reputation, 100% cash bonuses, so you are in the black right away. Most importantly, they have some of the fastest payouts in the industry, just 2 business days. You don't have to wait by the mailbox for a paper check. This week has a few lines that are very interesting. Georgia is still giving 5 or 6 to a red-hot Mississippi State team. And as Chris and I have been talking about, if you think this is the year that Kentucky finally beats Florida, the Gators are still favored by about a field goal. MyBookie's all-new mobile site makes placing bets a piece of cake. Join MyBookie now. Get in on the action. They're going to match your deposit up to 100%. Use the promo code SDS to activate this offer for week 4. Promo code SDS. Visit mybookie.ag today. All right, Chris, let's go in the Wayback Machine a little bit. It's going to take me a little while to finally get to my question, so just bear with me here. I was at Florida State from 93 to 97, so the fast break offense with Charlie Ward was like just being born as I was going to college. And I knew a couple of kids on that team, and as they told it, the fast break offense with the 4 wides and the shotgun and the hurry up and the single back set, they only had about 4 or 5 plays because they installed that on the fly out of pure desperate measures. It wasn't incredibly intricate. So you were there when Steve Spurrier's offense was just doing incredible things. It wasn't quite the fun and gun yet, I don't believe, because I don't think Coach Spurrier incorporated that shotgun until about 96 or 97, and you were gone by then. But my question to you finally is, just how complex was this passing game? Was it a phone book-sized playbook, or was it essentially smash concept, double post, curl flat, all verts, and you just run it time and time again with superior athletes catching the ball and pinpoint passers?
Yeah, I think you made a good point, whether it was purposely or inadvertently, I'm not sure, but you referenced that Florida State was developing that fast break offense, and they didn't run a lot of plays. And the reason they didn't have to run a lot of plays is because people hadn't really seen it before. Nobody was really doing what they were doing, so they were on the cusp of innovation. And teams really didn't know how to defend that offense very well, both with the scheme and the athletic pieces that they fit into that scheme. So I would say that it was a little bit of the same situation for us at Florida. I remember Coach Berger talking to us early in the 90s about how he developed this offense. And he said, and when he was at Duke, they sat down, and the only ways to be successful are, one, you either work harder than somebody else and you do something that everybody else is doing better than they do it, or you come in and you do something completely different. And that's what Coach Spurrier did in developing that offense. That's what he did when he came to the SEC and kind of revolutionized the conference, where everybody was still running the football a lot out of two back sets and a tight end. Now he's spreading folks out. And there were some pretty basic concepts to us now as we look back on them, but there wasn't a lot of people, you know, working the smash concepts as much, weren't working the curl flat as much, weren't working, you know, some of the post-dig stuff quite as much. So it was a situation where we were, you know, showing folks something new. We were substituting, you know, four and five wide receiver packages, and teams weren't playing much dime, nickel and dime stuff. So we had some matchups on safeties at times. But we really had the right guys in that spot. And I say right guys, I say the coaching staff, I say the players across the board. It was a special time at Florida and something that I'm really proud and fortunate to have been a part of. But and I think we worked so hard. And I talk about this all the time. We worked so hard on routes on air every day in practice that our timing was impeccable. And you don't see that from teams as much anymore. Teams now, they're practicing at such a fast pace to try to get a bunch of reps in. But I'm not so sure that those are quality reps. And Coach Spurrier was one that really emphasized coaching on the field. If guys made mistakes on the field, he was correcting them. You were running it right. Everybody was getting a mental rep in. And I just don't know if guys are getting that same kind of coaching in the way practices are being run these days, with the pace that it's being run and the lack of coaching and correction on the field.
Well, you are singing my tune, I swear. Missouri is a perfect example, if you ask me, mm-hmm. with Coach Heupel and that offense. I know they go a million miles an hour, and they snap the ball with 27 seconds left on the play clock time and time again. They can run it 100 plays a game, but are they 100 quality plays?
Yeah.
How many times do they snap the ball and the linemen aren't truly set, and the receivers are confused on the route concepts, and it's an aborted play. It happens way too often. So going fast for fast's sake doesn't make a lot of sense to me, and I think that single-handedly destroyed their defense on the other side of the ball.
It is. It's a whole symptomatic issue for that entire team. I think that's where it all spurs from, is you got a defense that's already not very deep. Last year, their defensive line was decimated with injuries, and you're putting those guys back out there. Whether it's three and out or you're scoring in three plays, they're right back out there on the field. So you're having to score, you know, 40 or 50 points just to win, because your defense is not going to stand up at that kind of tempo. I really think you have to the true sign of a great coach is somebody that adjusts what they do from a scheme standpoint to match the roster and the type of team that they have. And I don't think that offense necessarily is what's best for how that Missouri team is built right now and where their deficiencies are on defense.
Now, getting back to Coach Spurrier and the glory days of the 90s, do you think that offense could be run today? Would it be successful, or has the last generation or so, there's just been too much fast forward on offense and things are too advanced these days?
Yeah, I played in that offense at the Redskins. So my last season, as you referenced earlier, was 95, and then I was in the NFL playing for different coaches, and then I went back to playing within that offense in 2002, coach's first year at the Redskins when he took me up there. And, you know, there were a lot of folks that knew what we were doing, and that offense had evolved a little bit since I had been in it. You know, there were some different read things that were taking place, some different adjustments that we were running versus zone blitz stuff that maybe wasn't around really much when I was playing there. So there has to constantly, whatever you're doing, there has to be some evolution, because it's a constant spy versus spy situation in college football. And we've seen it over the years where one season it seems like the offenses have the advantage, and then the defenses catch up and they're dominating, and then there's some new wrinkles that get thrown in the next year by the offensive coordinators. So it's constantly an evolving battle between coordinators on both sides of the ball. I think Coach Berger is a good enough football coach that he would be able to find a way to make things work against the defenses of today. I also think he's the best play caller I've ever seen, particularly from the sideline. Very rarely do you see a guy that can call plays and have as good a feel from the sideline as what he had. But, you know, that was a special gift. But he's getting inducted into the College Football Hall of Fame again as a coach this time. He's one of the greatest that there's ever been, and certainly a guy that I owe an awful lot to. So I have no doubt that he'd be successful today coaching if he was still around.
Yeah, I have to admit, you're stealing a little bit of the thunder for what I have for my next question. You had a handful of stops in the NFL. I believe Washington was your last in 2002. And
I was in Pittsburgh
That's right.
03-04 after that.
That's right. That's right.
4 years after that. But, yeah, that was towards the end of the career for sure.
But Shane Matthews was on that team. Danny Werfel was on that team. It was Coach Spurrier's first year in the NFL. Is it safe to say he was just trying to create Gainesville North?
Well, I think what he wanted to do was have guys on the team that were familiar with what he wanted to do offensively. And whether that meant for production during the season or to help, you know, get the other guys coached up during the preseason. You know, there's a lot of time in the NFL that you get during the spring with OTAs and mini camps, with training camp in the fall, with preseason practices and stuff. So I really think that all of us, it was not only those guys you mentioned, but Riddell Anthony was there, Jaquez Green, Willie Jackson came through for a period of time too. So there was a lot of different Gator folks that were on that team. And really none of us got signed back the next year. I know the front office folks wanted to get away from the Gator ties. But if you look at our record, we were 7-9 that first year. They got rid of all of us Florida guys. They went 6-10 the next year. And I'll still say that was one of my favorite years in the NFL, just because of having an opportunity to be reunited with Coach Berger, with so many of those coaches that were around when I was at Florida, so many of the players that I had enjoyed success with at Florida. And being in the nation's capital, kind of the center of the whole universe, was really awesome too. So it was fun. I wish it would have lasted a little longer, but it did give me an opportunity to have my most successful season in the NFL to that point with production, and gave me an opportunity to play a couple more years in Pittsburgh with Bill Cowher and Mike Mularkey.
Now, you mentioned Coach Spurrier as a play caller and his gift for that. You know, Danny Sheridan was on Paul Feinbaum's show just this week, and he is a guy who's well-connected, to say the least. He believes that if some school outside the SEC offered Coach Spurrier a chance to be an offensive coordinator, that he would do it, that he would get back in the game. He wouldn't do it in the SEC because he doesn't want to go against Florida or against South Carolina. But do you truly think that he has enough of a niche that he needs to scratch it again? Or is he okay being sort of the glorified mascot with what he's doing in Gainesville these days?
I have a hard time believing that he would want to go back coaching in that capacity. One, because I don't think he's a guy that would do well under anybody else's umbrella. I mean, he's
going
to be the kind of guy to set the tone across the board. And that's really why our teams worked so well. We kind of took on that persona of Coach Spurrier. We had that arrogance about us. We showed up knowing we were going to win as the program evolved into 93, 94, 95. We really kind of embraced some of the way that he needled opposing teams during the offseason, whether it was Tennessee or Florida State or some of the stuff he was doing. So I just have a hard time believing he would feel comfortable not being the guy to kind of set the tone across the board in a particular program. But as you mentioned, I don't know that he's all that happy, and I can't speak to that, you know, directly, but my guess is that he's feeling a little underutilized, one of the greatest minds in the history of the sport. Being around it but not having anything to do necessarily with it has got to be frustrating. I mean, this guy was born to be involved with football. He was born to be a football coach, and when you're not doing what you were born to do, I imagine it's a little frustrating. So I'm not going to rule out that he wouldn't coach in a capacity like that, but it would be hard for me to believe that that would be the case. They just built a brand new house here in Gainesville, so I probably would think that he's not going to be running off anytime soon.
All right, this is my last line of questioning for you. You spent time in the NFL with four or five organizations. You were at a time when you played at Florida where there was just NFL guys littered on the roster, both sides of the ball, depth upon depth. And again, I'm going to bring this back to my Florida State experience. I want to ask you, a former teammate or maybe even just a guy at Florida who was incredibly successful in the NFL that maybe caught you by surprise a little bit. And then on the flip side, a guy who was sort of okay in college and you didn't see it, and all of a sudden he becomes a superstar in the NFL. They are different games to some degree,
yeah.
And I bring it back again to our position once upon a time. I say our, like I have your resume or something, but like Peter Warwick. Peter Warwick in college was absolutely untouchable. He would have won the Heisman Trophy in 1999 if not for the department store scandal, and they gave it to Ron Dayne instead. First round pick, and he was basically a bust in the NFL. He's teammates with Lavernius Coles, who was a good college player, not a great one. He had about half a dozen 1,000-yard seasons in the NFL, Redskins, Jets, very, very good player. Do you have examples of that from your experience of Florida, guys who sort of went a different direction than maybe you anticipated?
Yeah, it's interesting. I can name a bunch of guys that I thought were tremendous players in college that for whatever reason didn't have the same level of success in the NFL. And a lot of people always like to talk about us being products of the system. I really don't think that's the case. I mean, the system only works, as we've seen, with the right pieces in there. I think a lot of us on offense benefited from being in that system, but we certainly helped make that system what it was as well. I would say from the standpoint of guys that I played with that maybe had the most successful NFL careers, Ike Hilliard probably would stand out to me in that respect. But I can remember being on teams in the NFL where I'm looking around at our wide receiving core thinking, God, these guys aren't anywhere near as good as the group that I was with at Florida, whether it be early in my career with guys like Willie Jackson and Jack Jackson, Aubrey Hill, and Harrison Houston, or whether it be later in my career with Ike Hilliard, Riddell Anthony, Jacquez Green, Travis McGriff. I mean, there was constantly talent around us that was very productive. But in the NFL, as you mentioned, it's a different game, and you're going to keep typically five wide receivers, and if you're not one of the starters, you got to be productive on special teams. I think that's one of the things that hurt me over my career was I was never really good at the special teams play. I wasn't a return guy. I wasn't really big enough to do well on some of the special teams aspects if you're not a returner. So they look to build rosters a little differently, and I think that's one of the things that you you kind of see where maybe it guys that are great receivers don't get a chance to be that at the same level because they don't have what they need to fit on a roster as a guy that's a non-starter.
Chris, that was a lot of fun. Thanks so much for coming on the show.
No, thanks for having me. I appreciate it. I enjoyed it.
Absolutely. That was former Florida wideout Chris Doering. Be sure to watch him on SEC Network all season long. Also follow him on Twitter at Chris Doering. And thank you for listening to the Saturday Down South podcast. Special thanks to our friends at WDAE in Tampa, as well as our sponsors, Crystal and MyBookie. If you like what you heard, you can subscribe on iTunes or wherever your favorite podcast can be found. Be sure to give the show a rating as well. My name is John Crist. For all SEC all the time, visit SaturdayDownSouth.com.